Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, Jay Cutler. Started a new podcast called Uncut with Jay Cutler. Most of you know me from the NFL, some of you have seen me on Instagram, and some of you know me from the reality TV world. Each week I'm taking you along with me as we discuss football, trending topics, and whatever's going on in my life each week. I'm bringing along people that are special in my life. Former teammates, friends, and some new people that I like and respect. That's what you're supposed to do, right? Podcasting? I think I'm doing this right. Can't wait to get started with you. Go subscribe now. Uncut with Jay Cutler. Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Nikias Duncan of the Dunker Spot podcast, the You Late podcast, Basketball News, and we had a really fun, wide-ranging conversation about the league about a week in. Teams that are exceeding expectations or defying expectations, some are below, and players that are doing that. And we start out with our early takes on the officiating slash rule changes that are going on in the league. So conversation I really enjoyed, runs a little bit short of an hour. Hope you enjoy. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
It's always a challenge to make big pronouncements a week, really a week into the season, so I'm not going to ask you, and I'm not going to try to do that myself for any individual players or teams or anything like that. But I think that we have enough information now to think about, to share some thoughts and to get everything else. And at the place that I wanted to start, partially inspired by some of what I saw last night, is we're now 1 week into the regular season with the points of emphasis kind of changing some of the foul drawing antics that had existed before. How are you feeling about that? Like the changes, how it's affecting players, how it's affecting the product about a weekend?
I mostly feel fine about it. Like I'm glad that they've gotten out some of the, I guess, the cheaper foul drawing tricks, if that makes sense. I'm just kind of waiting on the course correction at this point. It's probably going to come within the next couple of weeks or so, because what it seems like has happened is that they've cut out that stuff and they're also just not calling blatant things at the rim. And I don't think that should be the answer. Like I appreciate having better game flow. And again, like getting out some of the arm hooking or some of the weird jumping to the side to draw fouls, like that stuff is objectively good. But also I'm seeing guys getting hammered at the rim and it's just like play ball. And I think that's probably a bridge too far.
Yeah. And I think that one of the encouraging parts to me about it is that it seems like at least so far, the referees have taken the ethos of the rule changes to heart, meaning like even some things that aren't rigidly within the, not even necessarily the letter of the law, but within the like kind of like the guidelines that have been put forth by the league, but are still kind of like cheap stuff are being called what I would say is correct for the way that I think the league should be officiated. Mm-hmm. And so that's good. But I agree with you that there, I see, so one way to differentiate it is that it's not rigidly this way, is that it's kind of like out on the floor versus around the basket. And this, in my ideal world, calling fewer kind of like cheap out on the floor things is not the same as just calling a lot fewer fouls in every facet of the game. Like if you get hammered around the basket, that's still a foul and that should be considered a foul. And like one of the weird ones that happened a couple of times in the Heat Nets game, which I watched on Wednesday, was refs just not really using what I would consider the traditional rules for charges. So like there was one where Dwayne Dedman was, not only did he get there late, something refs get consistently wrong, that it's about, you know, when the, it should be about when the guy takes off, not about when the contact occurs. But also like Dedman's heels were straight up in the restricted area. Like it wasn't even particularly clear. And so it's like, yeah, if you want to do some sort of spirit thing of like he was in the right vicinity beforehand and do that, well, okay, first of all, I don't think it qualifies under that. But second of all, like you have a rule on this. Like there, this isn't even like a letter of the law, spirit of the law type of thing. It's like, okay, you've had people, whether it's broadcasters or players or fans, pointing to that little circle that you deliberately put out there on the court. And it's like, well, if you're still gonna have that,
right,
and that's the rule, so you get into that. And so like, and then a couple minutes later, Kyle Lowry took a completely clean charge, and it's like, okay, that's the type of thing that we should reward. And I mean, even Lowry was moving a little bit, but it was within the, within like what I think is the kind of the tolerable realm. And so that ties in with what you're saying. It's like there's a difference between calling fewer of these things that should be excised from the game entirely and calling fewer fouls, period, and just letting a lot of stuff go.
Right. And I would say, like, I feel like the players are starting to feel it. Like, I was watching Timberwolves Bucks this morning, trying to catch up on that game. And there was a possession in which Pat Connaughton receives the ball above the break, and he pump fakes, a defender goes flying, and he just lets him fly by before continuing on with the possession. I was like, you know, this time last year, he probably would have jumped into him and got 3 free throws out of that. So I'm glad that players seem to recognize that some of the stuff that went last year isn't going this year as well. So I think some of that is starting to come. Now I'm just waiting on the referees to kind of adjust with the paint play, because again, I think that's a step too far from what I've seen so far.
Yet another one that we're kind of slowly seeing the behavior change, but it takes time, is for some of those Nate Duncan, the other end Duncan I've talked to this week, calls it the bridge to nowhere, where basically it's like the point guard is just dribbling around trying to find somebody to foul him, and they're not, you know, if there's nothing really going on in the play, and the you know, they're not getting baited as much, and there's still a couple. And I think that the ideal end game for a lot of this, and I would say it's the same if the league ever takes the proper step on adjudicating intentional fouls to stop fast breaks, the idea is not to call a bunch of these fouls. The idea is that the conduct that leads to those fouls doesn't happen anymore. And I think we're already getting, and that's what you were getting at with the Pat Connaughton thing, we are moving closer to that earlier than I expected, which is extremely encouraging. And that's why you kind of start, you know, as you're, and these aren't the first league officiating reforms that have happened, but it is a pretty ambitious slate of them, is that you start with some of the stuff that's most egregious, and then you work your way from there, and you adjust, and then, you know, there'll be, I'm sure, not only will there be the equilibrium shift that you talked about before, but also they will tweak these guidelines formally over the course of years, informally probably within this year, to get closer to right. And part of what makes this so encouraging to me is that, first of all, I think you can see some of the benefits already, and that it's a lot easier to get from where we are now to a better solution than it was where we were before.
Absolutely. Like, again, like, if there's one thing I can say, I have my nitpicking about how the officiating has been as they try to make these changes, but the flow of the game is so much better.
Yes.
Like, I'm so glad that we're not at like 3-hour regulation games at this point. Like, it seems to be a pretty smooth flowing experience, and I think that's going to, I mean, the fans seem to love it. From, you know, my timeline is only anecdotal, but like, my timeline has loved the way the games have been officiated this year, and they love that these games are flowing more smoothly. The slander has picked up for a few select stars since the season has started. So I do think the NBA has done right by their fans with this overall. But again, like, there's always room for better.
Yeah, there is. And I know that there has been a lot of discussion already on various players, whether we're talking about James Harden has been, of course, the most prominent, or Trae Young, or Steph Curry, and how it's going to change it. And I think we're still dealing with too small a sample size, especially with Harden, when you consider the injury that he dealt with and not really having an offseason. Like, I think this is going to affect him significantly, as will the passage of time, because he's getting older and everything else. But I'm kind of, it, to me, it's a little bit premature there. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, I think it's pretty early, especially with Harden. Like, I just wrote a piece on that on basketballnews.com about some of the factors with James Harden not getting to the free throw line as much. And, like, some of it is rules. Like, he's not getting the arm hook stuff like we're accustomed to seeing. Like, there was a play in the Bucks game in the opener in which he ISOs against Mamu, takes a step back three, kind of swings the leg, trying to draw a foul there, and the refs just kind of look at him. So, like, that stuff, again, the obvious stuff that isn't part of basketball, like, they are trying to curb, and that makes sense. But also, Harden is older. He didn't have much of an offseason. He is dealing with the hamstring. Like, there's some personnel stuff with no Kyrie. It's easier to shrink the floor against Brooklyn than it was last year. So, like, there's just a lot going on. I think it's a little too easy to be like, well, rules change, Harden playing bad, therefore Harden is a fraud. Like, we don't have to go that far.
No, and I sometimes get frustrated with how impatient people, and that can be media members, it can be people in my timeline, it can be anything, are to announce and determine things. Like, is it possible that these rules really affect James Harden, and that a lot of the stuff that he had been doing before, like that we didn't think was really part of the game, that this makes him a significantly worse player? Yes, that is a possibility. However, I'm going to need more than 5 games to feel that way, and it's going to, and I don't see the benefit. Like, I mean, are you advocating then that he's trash and the Nets should trade him or bench for something? No, not really. I mean, does it change their, if it ends up being true, does it change their likelihood of making the finals and winning a title? Yeah, absolutely it does. And so does Kyrie and a bunch of other things. But the other factor with Harden that I'm keeping an eye on is there are a lot of different ways to make to make Harden's game work. And this came up a little bit in the Heat contest where it was kind of a gross offensive game overall, but not having Nick Claxton, who was sick, seems like a non-COVID illness for that game. It was a reminder that Harden, I think his cadence works a lot better with a role man, especially one who can move to the basket quickly and who can catch lobs. Like, I mean, the chemistry that he had with Clint Capella and everything like that. And when like Harden's playing with LaMarcus Aldridge, he's not used to the opportunities that creates, and the opportunities that creates aren't as good for him.
Right, right. Like he's running some pick and roll with Paul Millsap, and it's just like, well, Millsap isn't a vertical spacer, and like he's a stretch guy, but at this stage of Millsap's career, like that's probably just a switch. So what you want to do is put James Harden in a situation where he can create advantages and also stress your defense. And it feels like without Nick Claxton, who has honestly, he struggled to begin this year.
Agreed.
Like without that kind of vertical threat, you're kind of stuck. Like what reason do you not have to just switch against James Harden right now?
Yeah, and Harden doesn't have the burst. I mean, so if you're switching a big onto him, he doesn't have the burst to get all the way there. And also, you can send more to recover. And as he's adjusting to the way things are called, like, I mean, he had a rock solid kind of like battle plan where it's like he was so just insanely gifted at knowing, like, if anybody's arm was out of place, how to go through it. And like, it's going to be a very significant adjustment for somebody, the person who in that facet of the game spent the most mental energy and had the most, I would argue in some ways, the most honed natural skill for mm-hmm. that element, to have that just be not something that's rewarded in the same way anymore. And like, yeah, you could argue in different ways, like Chris Paul, some of the stuff that he did in terms of stopping short and going into guys and knowing where everybody was. Like, I mean, they're both foul savants in different ways, I guess is one way to put it. But mm-hmm. Harden's, I think, requires a greater adjustment because it's like when he's driving, the thought process is just completely different now. Whereas Chris Paul's stuff was kind of more within a different kind of flow.
Right. And James Harden alluded to it in the postgame press conference last night, where he was like, you know, I'd love to get back to dropping 30 and 40. But like, I haven't been able to really play basketball. Like, my offseason was spent rehabbing. So in addition to like him just needing to get healthy with the rules changes, like he hasn't been able to experiment. OK, what works in the foul drawing range? And so like now he's pretty much, and shout out to PD Webb above the break three, tweeted this out on the timeline. Like, he's basically using the regular season not only to get in shape, but also it's kind of like a test study of like, OK, what works now in terms of foul drawing?
Yeah.
And having to do that on the fly while the roster is kind of in flux again. No Claxton, obviously no Kyrie, which is a whole different thing. It's a lot to sort through right now. And, you know, we're 5 games into the regular season, so we're probably having a different discussion entirely like 15, 20 games in once he gets more comfortable, once he gets healthier, once some of the guys get back. But right now, it's just a whole lot of moving parts.
Exactly. And I think that's a healthy way of thinking about it. And yes, the Nets are 2-3. And no, I'm not super concerned. But I mean, then there's also the question about, you know, like what roster are they going to have available and everything else. But it is really interesting. And I think that's a good way. So we talked about kind of that is that the idea of what we need to see and what we don't is a healthy approach in terms of everyone else. And so the way I like to think about this for myself is we'll start with the team's players, however you want to go, that have defied your expectations. And some of it will be just small sample size theater and you don't think it's going to be that same thing. But like, what has struck you so far that is different than what you expected?
I mentioned a little bit earlier, like I watched Bucks Wolves earlier this morning. The Timberwolves defense seems to be pretty legit right now.
Yeah.
And like I've been clamoring basically for the last 7-8 months, like, hey, if you're going to play pick and roll coverage with Karl Anthony Towns, please play him closer to the level of the screen. Drop is not for him. It's just not for him. He can't navigate the gap that well. He's not very good at leaping backwards. Like, that's just not him. Force some activity, get him close to the level, force some rotations behind it. You have athletes, if nothing else, on the back line. Just do that. And the Wolves have done that. And like some of the offensive talent that they face, like they faced New Orleans twice. The best offense they've faced so far is Milwaukee, but they did so without Drew and without Brook, who at least makes you think offensively with his ability to space the floor and also mash mismatches on the block. But the activity is there. I've been very impressed with what I've seen on film for them so far.
Yeah, I have been as well. And Chris Finch made a really, I would say, significant decision to make one of his primary lineups, and you know, like one that they've given real time to, Okogie and McDaniels together. And they were extremely disruptive defensively in that Rockets game, which is the game I watched the most. I've seen the Wolves a few other times, but like that was the one because Nene broadcasted it that I saw the whole thing. And my biggest concern there with that combination, along with particularly, well, actually, not even just particularly with Russell, Edwards, and Towns, like it, with anybody who's worse than them, it exacerbates it. Of like, well, okay, you have two very limited offensive players with that group. Is that going to work? And again, we're a small sample size seed here. We're 103 cleaning the glass possessions with Okogie and McDaniels on the floor together. This is, I just think, completely wild. Plus 12 net rating, but an 89 offensive rating. They've just been so crazy defensively that, so, I mean, obviously this is too small a sample to make any definitive pronouncements, but it's like, they've been unsuccessful, and some of that was like missed shots, and they had some weird stretches during that, but it's like, okay, well, they've been forcing that in the Rockets game in particular. They forced a ton of turnovers, but what I really like about it from Finch, and of course from the players, is that it's made everybody's roles more manageable, you know, so like, and I would have been very impressed with, like, especially Anthony Edwards, like, his aggressiveness level defensively and his execution has been so much better than it was a lot of last year.
Oh yeah, he flies around on the weak side now. Like, he's pouncing at the nail. He wants to jump the passing lanes. Like, he's having fun doing that. And I think that's the most important thing for a guy like that. When you have the athletic tools, you're waiting on, like, the mental aspect of it to catch up, just because this is year two for him in the NBA. The fact that he seems to be enjoying the effort and has really bought into what Minnesota wants him to do, like, that's a good sign moving forward.
Right. And the idea is not necessarily that Minnesota is going to stay the number two defense in the NBA, but sort of paralleling in some ways the Portland Trailblazers, where I don't think Minnesota's offense is going to be anywhere near as good as Portland's has been consistently during Damian Lillard's tenure, just because Damian Lillard is that kind of superlative player, and Towns is great, but, you know, Lillard, both with his ball dominance and just the incredible level of play that he's had. But what sinks kind of flawed teams is often that your defense is so bad that your offense can't make up for it. And I'm not even talking about, like, the feedback loops that if you're having to take the ball out of the basket the whole time, you're not getting as much of transition as everything else. It makes it so that you have to be insane on offense in order to be competitive against decent teams. Mm-hmm. And so if they're 15th, if they're 18th, if they're 20th, as opposed to being like 25th or worse, like, that makes a gargantuan difference.
Right. And that's all they need to do, because you have, again, he's not Damian Lillard, but you have a Karl Anthony Towns who can stress defense on all three levels. D'Angelo Russell is a pull-up threat. Anthony Edwards has been interesting to be on offense because he shot so well. It's weird with Ant in particular, because he shot well from three to start the season, and I may have liked six of the threes he's taken this year.
Yeah, so it's so funny. Like, the shot, so I if you think about, like, for me, the mechanics of a shot, like, his balance is something that I've noticed. It seems a lot better. But the shots he takes are not, like, they're better than, like, Georgia, for sure. But it's not like, it's like, oh, like, my theory on Anthony Edwards was, if you take out the, like, 15 to 20% worst shots in his profile at Georgia, it's like, there's a really effective player in there. And we've seen some of that, but it's more just like, he has become a better shooter, which is actually, you could argue in certain ways, even more encouraging, because if he can do the other part, what I thought was going to be the first part, if he does it second, then, I mean, then you're really cooking with gas.
Right, it's weird. Like, the good news is that he can get to his pull-up and these side steals whenever he wants, and the bad news is he knows that he can get to those pull-ups and the side steals whenever he wants, and so he just decides to do that. Like, there was a possession early in the Bucks game where he runs a pick-and-roll with Karl Anthony Towns. He draws a late switch. I was like, all right, cool. They're just going to swing the ball to the left wing. They're going to pitch it in to Cat. They're going to force a double to be able to play out of that. And instead, Anthony Edwards just kind of walks back Giannis, who switched out onto him. He just catches a pull-up in his face. And I'm just like, well, what am I supposed to say about that? Like, you don't want that from a process standpoint, but also shooting, particularly the pull-up shooting, was the biggest question mark with Anthony Edwards' profile. And if he could knock down those kind of shots over a contesting Giannis, like, it wasn't one of those duck under the screens set up shot and just fired. Like, he got into a rhythm dribble and knocked it down to space. Like, if he can knock down that shot, how do you guard Anthony Edwards?
Right. And so, I mean, that's why the future is really exciting with him. I'm still trying to figure out, Exactly. And I mean, Anthony Edwards, this is his age 20 season. He doesn't turn 21 until next offseason. There's a lot of time for him to figure this out, but it's, and this happens a lot for the kind of like wing size guys, is where, okay, what is his ideal role within a really good offense? So is he a high volume secondary scorer? Is he somebody that you trust to have the ball in his, or is it just a very different structure? And part of what makes Minnesota so tantalizing to me over the next couple of years is that Edwards might be kind of a challenging guy to square. Like, maybe he ends up, I mean, I'm not saying they're the same player at all, but like in kind of the Zach LaVine mold or something like that, where it's not like a true, like the same thing. He's not like Mike Conley, you know, but he's a but still has a large role within the offense and is getting better at doing it. But Karl-Anthony Towns is so gifted and so unusual that maybe the concept for Chris Finch and the Wolves is just the normal rules don't apply to us. We're just going to have to find our own balance because sort of like the Denver Nuggets, you don't want to go under the traditional paradigm because that is actually typically that underserves a big that's as talented as Towns is.
Right. And like, I just love the Denver confidence unit, period. Because like, I do think you have a guy like Cat is not a Jokic level passer, but like you do have a guy that you can legitimately run your offense through. It's not just some delay stuff to get guys going downhill. Like you can legit to say, hey, we're going to run a high post play that is designed for Carl to find a cutter or to find a shooter after some screening action. Like he's that kind of guy. And so when you have that on top of him being one of, if not the best big man shooter we've seen, then like a lot of things can be simplified. Like I want to see what the chemistry with him and Anthony Edwards becomes moving forward. Cause like, it's already good. Like they're already finding chemistry and pick and roll. Like some of the rescreens we see from Cat, you get those two in an empty corner. Like there really isn't much you can do as long as Ant keeps his head up. So like, I think ideally Minnesota wants Ant to kind of be the lead dog, maybe not a Luka like every possession you're bringing the ball up guy, but as far as who's initiating and who's getting downhill first, like I think they want him to be that guy and then allow D'Angelo Russell to play off of that. I think that's the best structure for them, but it's just kind of finding that balance between where you want to get those guys those opportunities.
And D'Angelo Russell is overpaid, and I think some would say overqualified to play that kind of like more of a spot-up secondary tertiary creator role. But I also think it's something he's better suited for than the other ones. And so it is this weird dynamic where it's like, yeah, you're not paying a guy. And I mean, first of all, Gerson Rosas, who traded for him, isn't there anymore. You're not trading for a guy to have him be that role, but I think it can work reasonably well. And then also theoretically, I think you want Russell to be, Finch is going to want to manage the rotation so that Russell is the guy whenever Towns is out. And so you go to, you know, with Reed and you go with some other structures. Something else we're such a small sample size and Minnesota's only played four games as we record this. Edwards actually at this moment has basically an identical true shooting percentage to last year, despite making more of his threes and taking a higher proportion of his shots from three. And that's because he's had a drop off in 2-point efficiency and also getting to the line a little bit less. And I'm not like, when I've watched film, I haven't seen anything there. I think there's just some of it's a little anomalous. He's shooting 11% on floaters, but not taking that many of them, you know, a couple of those type of things. But it is interesting that's like, I wasn't super worried other than some of the shot selection stuff about Edwards from two. I'm not worried right now, but it's like, that's another way that he'll improve. And I think some of that will just be regression of the mean.
Yeah, I think it's going to be some regression and just growing experience with the ball. Like, again, Chris Finch is also trying to figure some things out with these lineups. Like, one of the things I noted in the Bucks game was like, they would get a switch for Karl-Anthony Towns and he would have a size mismatch. And then you look at what's happening behind it. Like, there was a possession where you had, I want to say, Jared Vanderbilt and Anthony Edwards cut at the same time. And it's just like, well, you can't do that. And with Milwaukee bringing the double, if you have two non-shooters on the floor, period, like it just makes it more difficult to work with that. So like, some of the ways you could generate some rim touches for Anthony Edwards is for him to cut while Towns is on the block. And like, that doesn't seem to be an option right now, just because they're trying to figure out the general spacing and also who needs to be on the floor with those guys at the same time. So like, I think as we get more of a sample, as they play more and as the lineups get figured out, like I do think Anthony Edwards will be able to get downhill more. Like, I think that's where he's at his best. And once you have that, like, again, Cat can kill you from anywhere. Anthony Edwards can get downhill. He's so strong. Like, there really isn't much you can do with him with a head of steam. And once he's able to mix that in better with the growing pull-up jumper, he's going to be a problem. And D'Angelo Russell is able to play off of all of that attention. And as you mentioned, like, he's probably overqualified for that. So they have a really interesting three-man core offensively.
Yeah. Speaking of interesting three-man cores, as it were, the team, so Minnesota, I would say, is probably number two on my list. The team that has surprised me the most is Cleveland. And I didn't get to watch much of the preseason. I was otherwise occupied. And thinking about it conceptually, it's like, okay, they're going to start Markkanen, Mobley, and Jared Allen together. And, I still have some of the offensive concerns with that group. And they've actually played a lot with Rubio because of the time that Darius Garland missed. But they've defended a lot better. And a lot of that, I mean, Evan Mobley has been not than I anticipated that he would be, because I was low on Evan Mobley, just because rookies, whether they're playing power forward or center, rookie bigs take time. And he's been better earlier than I expect basically any young big to be defensively.
Yeah, like, I was worried about, one, what the lineup constructions were going to be. Because, like, I didn't think Evan Mobley, even though it's going to be his best position long term, I didn't know in year one if Evan Mobley would be able to handle a lot of minutes at the five. He's looked good when doing that. Mm-hmm. I worried about the spacing offensively with him at the four and playing with Jared Allen. That has been more tenable than I thought. And he looks so much more comfortable than I expected. Like, he's driving with a little bit of juice. Like, he's attacking the offensive glass with a little bit more physicality than I thought. Defensively, he's flying around all over the place. He's contesting shots all over the place. He is still not fouling, which is something that carried over from his days at USC. He has been incredible. I don't know if we have enough superlatives. Again, we're working with a small sample size right now. But, like, I don't know if there are enough superlatives for what he's done to start this year.
And on top of that, you brought up the idea of, like, how kind of things aren't moving too fast for him, which is so surprising. And I've noticed it more actually on the offensive end, where Mobley has limitations, and he's not the greatest shooter yet, and we'll see where that goes later in his career. Again, 20 years old, doesn't turn 21 until, unless the Cavs make the finals next season. But the idea of using him at least part-time as a hub is plausible to me. I'm not saying you necessarily want to build the whole thing around it now, but basically, Sam Vecenie and I talked about it a lot last year, and Mobley, the film on him, and I've seen him in person going back a couple years, like, the squint idea was kind of like Bam Adebayo. And Bam, I had long fears that Bam was going to be kind of his generation's Draymond Green, meaning a player who we don't appreciate what makes him special. So comparing players with similar, kind of like, not every undersized power forward is the next Draymond Green, like that sort of a thing.
Right.
And Mobley doesn't have, they're not the same player in many ways. But part of what I like about Bam is that, like, and the Bam Mobley comp is that I don't think, knowing what we know right now, that Mobley can, and even though I've liked a lot of the connective tissue in his offensive game, like the passing and some of the decision, like broader than passing decision making that we've seen from Mobley so far, I don't think he has the overall like ability of somebody like a Jokic or Towns, where you're, they're your every down running back offensive creativity wise. But there are ways to use players with his gifts. And especially with Cleveland's roster still being in at least some version of flux, it's exciting because Mobley having more capability is something that I'm hopeful they can use.
Right. Like, I think the palette is pretty clear for this dude, and he already has a very high baseline of skills. Again, like, he's not a Jokic level passer, but he is a guy that you can run stuff through now. And I'm very excited to see what him and Darius Garland is going to look like in pick and roll as Garland is more consistently healthy. Because I do think on a night that Garland has it going and you're getting two to the ball, or you're just playing a team like a Denver that plays Jokic higher in pick and roll, you can kind of create those short roll opportunities. Like, the high lows between Evan Mobley and Jared Allen, like, they're going to be there. Like, he can see that and he can pick that out pretty smoothly. And with a guy like Evan Mobley, he may not be a high level self creator, at least not right now, but because of his length and because of his touch, like, you don't need him to create wild advantages, if that makes sense. Like, if you get him within that 8 to 12 foot range, like, he could just sprinkle in jump hooks and push shots and floaters, which is unusual for that position, but, like, he has that touch, he has that ability. So, like, the pathways to him being an effective offensive player aren't that long. Like, he can already find his way as a passer, as a play finisher, and he has so much room to grow. Like, again, like, not enough good things to be said about Evan Mobley right now.
Absolutely. One thing that's lingering a little bit for me that I want to put a pin in, we're small sample size, so many things are going well for them, that I want to put a pin in is that the Cavs have been really bad on the defensive glass in the, whether we're talking about the Markkanen, Mobley, Allen triumvirate, or even when they're playing with like Okoro, Mobley, and Allen as the 3-4-5. I think of that, you know, like, as being, some of it is just kind of learning where everything is and you know, going for blocks and a couple of other things. But like, they're basically like, they're towards the bottom of the league in defensive rebounding when Mobley and Allen play together. And I will want to take a look around Thanksgiving at where that is. And if it's still bad, then I'll probably start really looking into film. And I'll keep an eye on it when I'm watching the Cavs.
Right, right. And that was a minor knock against, well, I guess maybe not minor, but that was a knock against Evan Mobley coming out. Like, the rebounding wasn't there for him in particular. And like, with him and Jared Allen, like, Jared Allen has historically not been a great defensive rebounder.
Yeah.
Like, he's that's always been kind of the thing, that's that physicality with him. You get him up against a bulkier dude, like, he struggles. So that is a pitfall, but I think they're banking on being able to create events defensively with all the length they have swarming around. Like, they've been able to do that. So I'm with you. I just want to see more.
So I'll let you, I have a player that I want to discuss, but let's talk teams first. If there's any other team that really sticks out to you as defying your expectations early, positive or negative?
I'm kind of on the fence with Toronto right now, because heading in, I was like, okay, this is a team that's going to struggle in the half court. They're going to be really good defensively, and, you know, the swing is going to be transition. Like, can they create good enough looks? Can they get out and transition enough? And, like, the defense has somehow been better than I expected, and the half court offense is worse than I expected somehow. So I'm still trying to get a feel on them. Like, OG Anunoby, he was my most improved player pick heading into the year. He started the season off terribly, and the last three games, he has looked like the most improved player in the NBA.
Yeah, I mean, he had 16 points in the first quarter against the Pacers in their win. And so the game that I watched most intently with them was the Celtics one, when they were really dominant. And it was the question for me with, so I get the duality that you were kind of going after. It was my same challenge with Toronto, was like, I thought the half-court offense was going to be bad. And having Siakam around just because he's a capable basketball player will help, but I also don't know, it's not like going to solve everything for them. And right now, the Toronto Raptors are fifth from the bottom, using Cleaning Glasses version, in half-court points per possession. Their offensive rating in half-court is 83.3, which is distinctly not great. By the way, Detroit, 70 points per 100 possessions in the half-court, which is incredible. But Toronto, 25% of their possessions are in, like, other stuff. So I think that's transition, and I believe that counts offensive rebounds as well. And so, like, that's great. Like, so if that split happens, then, I mean, you're probably not great offensively. I mean, but you're okay. It is a really challenging pendulum swing, because what happens is that means that you can kind of beat anybody and lose to anybody, because you, like, it only takes, and it can even be like the weird, like, luck stuff. Like, I talked a lot last year about how Toronto, like, they gave up a ton of threes, and their opponents hit a ton of those threes last year, which they had not in previous years. And so, like, it could end up being things like that, of like, you defended really well in the possession, but that fadeaway from player X goes in, and so you have to take the ball out of the basket, and then you do it, and then they get transitioned, all that kind of stuff. Like, I feel like it's going to be a really weird year. Like, the Raptors are going to beat multiple top five teams, and then are going to be, like, at least, like, one of the Oklahoma City Thunder's wins.
That sounds about right. Like, even when Pascal comes back, like, the question I had, and I talked about this, there was a Twitter space I was in. But my thing was, like, if I'm a defense, or if I'm just a head coach facing the Raptors, like, what prevents me from just switching everything? Like, all right, beat my switch. Win 1-on-1. Even when Pascal comes back, like, he's going to be their best, like, mismatch hunter that they have right now. But, like,
my funniest thing with this is, try to imagine the Toronto Raptors trying to score against the Toronto Raptors.
It would just be
like, because there was a point in that Celtics game where Fred VanVleet was getting switched onto Tatum kind of regularly, and they're like, fine, you know, like, it's okay. And like, Jason Tatum is a much better offensive player than anyone on the Raptors.
Right, like, this, I don't know what you, that's my discomfort with Toronto as like a playoff or play-in team, because it's just like at a certain point you got to be able to score in the half court in some way. Like, even if you just have one mismatch that you can kind of spam late in games, like there has to be something. And like right now, like Scotty Barnes looks much better than expected, another rookie that's performing well, but like he's not a mismatch, you know, outside of the offensive glass. Like, he's not going to do that consistently. OG's learning how to do it. Pascal, when he comes back, like some of the question marks with him was like, can he consistently do that as a number one guy? Because it's been pretty uneven since Kawhi Leonard's been gone. So I don't know. I'm enjoying them on defense, and I'm enjoying them in transition when they aren't blowing layups. But I just need to see more from them.
Yeah, and something, I mean, they basically haven't played any very much this year. Toronto's performance in close games late, that what you're bringing up of the spamming, like that, I mean, that is going to be, like, I mean, that could end up being a circumstance of, like, why they underperform their point differential potentially this year, is that they just don't, that those, like, and that it's going to be hard for them to come back. Like, let's say they're, unless they can get something in transition, let's say they're 4 points down with a minute to go. Like, can they get 5 points on two possessions? Like, maybe, but that's going to be a lot of work for them.
Yeah.
One other one I wanted to ask you about, I mean, they've only played 3 games so far. I am trying not to be fatalistic about the Mavericks, because I've been so low on Jason Kidd as a coach for a while now, and they have Luka and everything else. How are you feeling about Dallas in this early, early, early juncture?
I feel like I'm a little bit higher on them than I was a week and a half ago.
Interesting.
In a weird way. And like, I'm still generally low on them because I just don't think they have advantage creators outside of Luka. And that's a problem for me, especially in a playoff context. Because we've seen that in 2 straight postseasons where Luka goes supernova, then he gets tired and it's like, all right, who else? And it's, you know, year one against the Clippers, KP was down, so it was no one. And year two, KP might as well have not been there. And so I'm still struggling with that. Some of the offensive design stuff I've seen from Dallas has been mostly fine. And so I came into it like, okay, Jason Kidd's the worst coach ever. I don't think this is going to work. And like, that stuff's been better. I've been more concerned with Dallas's personnel than I have been with Jason Kidd.
Yeah, personnel. And I would say, like, especially like for me, the game I watched most closely was their, by far their worst game, when they got their butts kicked by the Hawks. And some of it was personnel, and some of it was like, in that game, their point of attack defense was straight up terrible for most of the game. And that was a problem. Like, we focus, like, playing Dwight Powell and Porzingis together brings different challenges, but it, like, just like came up a lot with the Jazz in their series against Clippers last year, all of those conversations matter a lot less when the guy who's guarding the ball is just getting driven by every time.
Right. And that's, I don't know. Like, I it's obviously early, and Luka is so good that he can make a lot of the stuff not matter.
Yes.
But I just dislike so much around Luka. I think it's kind of where I'm at with Dallas, honestly.
Yeah, and it's concerning. Like, I've been a Maxi Kleba believer for a long time, but it's waning. I mean, and he's a little bit older. He came into the league late, and the Mavericks don't have, and this was a criticism of mine, like, kind of was one of the things I was worried about with Kidd, is that I don't think they have much of a margin for error defensively, just because their defensive personnel isn't great. Like, they can't run a lot of different schemes. They don't have that many really capable perimeter defenders, and they have some guys that can be functional, to be sure, but like, and I mean, Bullock was a part of a good defense last year. I think Luka can be, and I like some of their other guys, like Finney Smith, but it's like, okay, where is the growth going to come from and everything else? So I think it's too early to be like in any specific mold with them, but I've been fascinated with Dallas for such a long time that it's not going to change now.
Yeah, especially on the defensive end, like, Dallas has a much worse version of the Utah problem that I have, where it's like, I love Royce O'Neal and he's a good defender, but if he's your best perimeter defender, then I kind of have issue with where you're at.
Yeah.
Within a playoff
conference. I describe that sometimes, it's a little bit different, but the theory with Robert Covington that was always so weird is that Robert Covington is a very good forward defender, but what he's worst at is defending talented wings. It's like, okay, well, you can use that, but it's harder to use.
Right. And so with Dallas, it's just like Dorian Finney-Smith and Reggie Bullock can't be it. It's like, how do you go small if those are your two best forward defenders?
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
And like, if you're relying on Maxi, again, like, he had some good possessions against Kawhi and PG during the playoff series and stuff like that, but like, if you're relying on that, that's problematic. And even trying to build a boat out of those kind of guys and maintaining some sort of, giving Luka some sort of relief offensively, that's a tough thing to do. So I'm with you. Like, lineup versatility, scheme versatility kind of isn't there, particularly defensively. I don't know. I'm trying not to be fatalistic.
But Luka's so good, it might be more of a playoff problem than a regular season problem, at least yeah. in the macro sense. Like, maybe there'll be a couple games where we go a little crazy, but, like, that they'll still be there. The player I wanted to talk about is Miles Bridges. And, I mean, yes, he was the Eastern Conference Player of the Week in the first week of the season. But he has shown a lot more growth to his overall offensive game than I expected. And, yeah, he's shooting more threes, and they're going in still at a high rate. But just putting the ball in his hands a little bit more and good things happening was stunning to me.
Yeah, Miles Bridges was one of my more fun watches last season, because I'm watching Hornet games mostly for LaMelo, but I want to see how the Hayward fit was going to be and things like that. And like once or twice every game, wouldn't even lead to a maker, maybe not even a shot attempt sometimes, but once or twice every game, Miles Bridges would make like a cross-court dime or a random pocket pass. Or, like, if there's a swing sequence, he just makes it quicker than I expect him to. And it's just like, wait, he has something. I didn't know that he had this. Like, I always pictured Miles Bridges as, like, obviously the violent dunker, but more of a play finisher overall. Like, he can operate in the pick and roll for you some. He can knock down shots on the perimeter. Obviously, a lob threat can get going and transition. But, like, in the half court, it's like, this guy's kind of slinging the pill a little bit. And so I'm glad that Charlotte has leaned into that a little bit more and just giving him more on-ball responsibility. Like, they're letting him boogie. And you combine those kind of passing chops with the kind of violence that he has at the rim and off the ball, like, he's just shooting the leather off the ball right now. Like, you have to close out on the hard, which is going to open up more of those drives. Like, it makes sense. Maybe not Eastern Conference Player of the Week sense, but it makes sense that he's taking a step. Like, he just looks a lot more comfortable out there.
Well, and you think about kind of how this all fits together, that playing Bridges, I don't think the shooting is necessarily going to be like right now as we record this, he's shooting 40% on 7.5 threes per game. Do I think that's going to continue? Probably not, but I would be thrilled if it did. I'd be really thrilled if it did. But that he has somebody who can be the lead creator, who can find him, that you can generate these advantages. Like a comparison, though they're not the same remotely as players, is like Joe Harris gets a ridiculously large amount of opportunities where he has an advantage. And Joe Harris, because it's the thing he is best at, uses most of those to take jump shots. But if Miles Bridges can use, he's not going to generate that many because it's not, you know, the Hornets are not the Nets, and they probably aren't going to be at any point in the near future. But if Bridges can use those advantage opportunities better than I thought he could, and create advantages more reliably, then sort of like we were talking about earlier with Anthony Edwards, it becomes a different balance. And that creates a lot, and that makes life easier, you know, means that the Hornets are probably asking for less from their other perimeter players. Now, I think, you know, having Rozier back will help a lot of this stuff. And maybe my frustrations with their decisions at center will matter a little bit less. Though I'm still freaked out about their defense and probably will be all year.
Yeah, the defense is giving me some pause. And I think a lot of that is tied into their center room to where, you know, it all kind of comes full circles. I did not expect Miles Bridges to start at the four over PJ Washington.
Same.
I understand why, because they need someone competent to fill those backup minutes when Mason Plumlee isn't out there, which God bless Mason Plumlee. And a quick shout out to Nick Richards, who did look good in one Boston game. But I wish I felt better about their interior. If I felt better about their interior, like, I would have some takes to get off about the Hornets right now. But I don't. So once we get a little bit of shooting regression, then I just want to see where they're at.
Yeah, it's like it's the question of, are they more than league pass dynamite? And they're definitely that. And I mean, especially with Bridges showing more and LaMelo and everything else. And you could argue that teams that are really fun offensively and bad defensively are actually more fun to watch. But for the transition, it's going to be there. And then the other challenge that James Borrego and Kupchak, it's a coach question and it's a GM question separately and together, is where do they take it from here? So if Bridges, you know, like Bridges looks like a no-brainer starter, then are you thinking of PJ Washington as kind of a 20-minute a game, fill the holes at the four and the five? Are you thinking that he's overqualified for that? Are you thinking that's about the right role for him? And then do you start to get into some of the really interesting stuff, which is, well, what would we consider doing with Gordon Hayward? Not because Hayward is like a bad player or because he's a poor fit or anything like that, but like, they're not at this point yet. But, and I don't know that PJ Washington is good enough to force this issue, but will they have to kind of figure out how to put these puzzle pieces together differently?
I think it's something they're going to have to consider a little bit sooner than they anticipated. Like, I think, you know, Miles Bridges is extension eligible this coming offseason.
Yep.
And PJ Washington, the offseason after that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Bridges will actually, so small clarification, Bridges will be on his new contract next season. The extension window is closed, and PJ Washington will be extension eligible, so his contract will start in 23-24. So you're right on that. I just wanted to make sure I'm a detailed nerd, though. I just want to make sure the terminology was there.
Oh, no, understandable. So, like, they're going to have to figure that out on top of Gordon Hayward making north of $30 million. And so what they do with the center room is going to be interesting. Because one thing that's kind of been percolating in my mind over the last couple of days, like, I haven't written about anything like that, but it's just like, at what point do we see the rumor from, like, Jake Fisher at Bleacher Report or something that Charlotte's sniffing around Miles Turner?
I started smiling when you were setting it up because I'm like, Kevin Pritchard already tried to trade Miles Turner for Gordon Hayward.
Yeah, so I'm just like, when does that become a thing? And maybe it's not for Hayward. Maybe it's Rozier in Washington or something. Like, I don't know what the construction is, but I'm just like, that fit seems to make sense to me. If for no other reason than to shift Mason Plumlee to the bench, because, like, he's not a starter quality center on a playoff team. But, like, when does that start to happen? And just with PJ in general, like, I wonder how Charlotte really views him. Because I do think he's a starter quality guy. Like, he's gotten off to a rough start. He's been hurt, and he hasn't shot well from three, and we're working with a 3-4-game sample size. So, like, whatever. But, like, PJ Washington's good. Like, that guy can legitimately shoot. He shoots well enough to force closeouts from fives anyway. And he's shown flashes of being able to hit corner shooters, being able to find cutters. Like, the placement of some of his passers bothers me, but, like, the idea is there, and that can get better with more reps. Like, he is a gap filler in the classic sense at center. Like, he can shoot, he can post up a small guy, he can screen for you and just force mismatches for other guys to attack. So that's going to be something that I'm keeping an eye on. As for the Hayward point, like, I think they need him just because LaMelo is not, he's not a closer I trust yet, mostly because of the shot profile. Like, he's still trying to figure out things at the rim and still trying to figure out things in the intermediate area. Like, the floater, he has a lot of versatility with the floater, but he needs to be a little bit better at that from my eye. Gordon Hayward's really the only three-level scorer that they have right now. So I don't think they make a move on that until LaMelo grows more in that aspect or if Miles Bridges takes an even bigger leap offensively.
Right, and it's way too risky to put all of these eggs in the LaMelo basket, unless the other way that you could do it is you really believe in Terry Rozier as a creator, and Rozier's been better than I anticipated. But I the other kind of fascinating element of it is that while I am a firm believer in the value of wing-sized guys, Miles Turner might be more unusual than like a starting caliber wing-sized guy, especially if, like, I mean, and there was this idea for a long time of, like, okay, well, if you play a floor spacing five, then that means you can play somebody, like, I remember this, like, I even used to say this with Porzingis and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist when the Mavs got him. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you can do with that is play a five that can space the floor and then just have a lot more real estate to operate. And then you make life easier on LaMelo. And so I think that the risk premium of trading Hayward is really high unless you think you have that secondary creator, especially because you need a primary for when LaMelo is not playing well or off the floor or everything else like that. But, oh God, the Turner possibilities are just so interesting for me.
The big man room in Indiana in general, just intrigues and confuses me.
Well, and there's a weird parallel with Indiana and Toronto, where I like a lot of the players that they have, but I don't necessarily like them together. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about how those players could be other places and I would enjoy it more. Like, Turner Sabonis it's worked better than I anticipated. But, like, for me, like, Fred VanVleet is maybe the ultimate of that. Like, I love Fred VanVleet. He's an important part of what the Raptors are doing. But would I rather see Fred VanVleet as, like, as the third best player on a team that, or fourth best player on a team that's a title contender? You bet, because we already saw it, and it was pretty great.
Yeah, like, he more than, I don't want to say more than any point guard, because, like, there are a lot of point guards worse than him, obviously. But, like, he needs, like, a big wing creator just to take some pressure off of him. Like, he should not be initiating your offense. Like, he just does not have it at the rim. He doesn't have it anywhere outside of the three-point range. And, like, you just don't want him pounding the ball into the dirt and taking those off-the-dribble shots as, like, your primary guy. So it's not fair to him that he's in the role that he's in. Like, there's only so much you could do there.
Yeah. Anything else you're feeling a lot of pressure? I mean, you have, of course, other wonderful opportunities to talk about things. Anything else that you feel like you want to discuss, or are we good to go?
I will copy my co-host at the Dunker Spot, Steve Jones Jr.'s homework for a minute. Like, Ja Morant has been freaking incredible.
Oh, my God. Amazing.
He has been absurd. Like, he looks so much more comfortable against teams ducking under picks with him. Like, he's firing those jumpers with more comfort. He's chewing up space when they drop too far against him. The craft in the half court has risen somehow, and he was already super crafty as a playmaker. Man, if the three point shot is real with him, good luck.
Yeah, and I mean, with Ja, the other pieces, I mean, the jaw-dropping athleticism, but also, like, I really liked a lot of his passing vision last year, but it was always kind of like, will he figure out, and can he figure out the weaknesses, at least to the point where all the other stuff becomes truly scary? And I'm not saying he's there now, but I'm saying the early returns are that he's more likely to get there than I had thought, and that is so exciting.
Shout out to Memphis. Talk about another team that has a lot of players that I like. Memphis has a lot of them. Also, please, I want Brandon Clark to flourish. That's just my personal bias. I want to see him in the rotation consistently all year long. I want to see him getting back to knocking down jumpers, because I don't know what the heck happened to it last year. Yeah, Memphis has been a fun watch for me early in the season.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to keep an eye on their defense. I've gotten asked about that a couple times recently, because it's still a concern there as we record this, dead last. But they're not playing without Dylan Brooks, and they're still figuring some stuff out. I'm not super worried yet.
Yeah, we'll see. Like, I think the big swing for them this year is how much time can Jaren Jackson Jr. play at the five?
Yep.
And, like, he's been flying around on defense, to his credit. Like, certainly not an elite-level guy. Like, there are still some deficiencies. I still don't love him as a rebounder. Like, he still can be a little overeager. The fouls are creeping back. But I'm just glad he's on the court, as simple as that is. Like, last year was kind of unfair to him, to where he was hurt. His, you know, getting back into the flow of things was Memphis in the play-in race. And then you get Utah, of all teams, to try to sort things out defensively and all the actions that they run. So, like, I'm glad he's actually had an offseason, looked really good in preseason, and he's been mostly fine this year. Like, has to figure things out from two-point range. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, and the other kind of connecting pieces that you're Jaren Jackson wanting to play center and wanting Brandon Clark out there, those two things could be happening together.
My heart, if it does.
Well, thank you so much for taking time. Pleasure as always.
Thanks for having me, man.
Thanks again to Nikias for taking the time to come on. You can listen to him on the Dunker Spot podcast with Steve Jones Jr., the You Late podcast with Jasmine Watkins, and you can read his writing at Basketball News, including the James Harden piece that we discussed relatively early on in this podcast. You can also, of course, follow Nikias at Nikias NBA, NekiasNBA. Love having him on and getting that perspective in the early going, where sometimes it can be hard to separate, in some ways, especially with good things, to what is genuine enthusiasm from being the real thing. And over the course of the next few weeks, we will get a much better sense of that. And if you want to support this show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode, whatever podcast player you're using, that can really help. And the show's never going to come out on a specific day of the week. There's no pattern to get into, so subscribing is the way to make it happen. And you can also help other people find the show, whether that's through word of mouth or by leaving a rating, leaving a review in the podcast, whatever you're choosing. It really does make a difference, helps other people find the show. You can also check out my other work, Nate Duncan and I Going Strong with Dunked On and Dunked On Prime. Dunked On, the free one, is actually now 2 episodes a week, because we are releasing the podcast version of our Twitter Spaces conversations, which are every Tuesday. That is a podcast, as well as what will typically be the 15 and 60s on Sundays. And then Dunked On Prime is the rest of the week. And I actually did a Discord chat for Total Access subscribers, which was really fun, this past week. And they also, if you weren't there live, you got a transcript. And then also you can check out the NBA cast. Nate and I are doing Blazers Sixers on Monday, 7 Eastern, 4 Pacific. Really excited about that one. And we'll be doing that Mondays throughout the season. We truly love getting the opportunity, appreciate it, from the NBA to do games, and you can actually watch it with us via League Pass. It's pretty cool. I also am in the process on a couple of pieces. Actually, I have one that's basically ready to submit for The Athletic, so you can look for that in the next few days, depending on how long it takes to get through editorial and for me to actually submit it, and have a few other things in the fire. I think my goal is to do roughly a piece a week over the next little while, depending on a few different factors. If you have any feedback feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I will try to get back to you. I've actually been a little bit better this past week, but the promise is that I will read it. So if it's feedback on the show, hey, do this, do that, somebody to have on, that sort of thing, it really does make a difference. And while a lot of people are on my radar, knowing that, you know, like at one point Nikias was there where I was already reading his stuff and people were like, you should have him on. And so started going through and I was already thinking about it, but you know, it's a little bit of a push. And so I really do appreciate that for whoever you think would be a good one, especially in some ways if they've never been on the show before, because then they're almost always in my mind to some extent. So that is more than enough for now. Thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.